Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Welcome this morning to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have, today is December 10th, 2019, and we have six cases on our calendar, four of which are scheduled for oral argument. The first case this morning is A19-0800, Woodard versus Crumrie. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Go ahead and take the podium. As you may already know, it adjusts up and down with a toggle switch at your waist there. And then whenever you're ready, just please state your name and the party you represent for the record, and we'll be ready to go.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Daniel Eaton for appellant and plaintiff Skylar Woodard. The law does not allow someone to be punished for prudently planning his or her eventual death. But that's the result of the district court's decision in this case. Jeffrey Woodard was dying of cancer. Knowing this, he did what any prudent father and owner of property should do.
But is that the issue in this case? Isn't the issue what does the contract require and whether that contract is enforceable and whether the respondent enforced, you know, the rights under the contract? Whether this was a good probate strategy is not before this court, right?
Those are the key legal issues. Yes, certainly there is a policy issue behind all of this, but absolutely, those are the key legal issues. And so as far as these legal issues go, the district court erred in three primary areas. First, looking at the contract for deed itself, the district court failed to recognize that the anti-assignment provision was unenforceable because it's an unlawful restraint on alienation. And second,
what case law do you have in support of that?
So the key case on that is the Holiday Acres case referenced in the briefing. And that case is instructive because the Holiday Acres court makes two important findings. First, the Supreme Court accepts the notion that a due on sale clause is not automatically an unlawful restraint on alienation. And this is specifically because it's not a strict restraint on alienation. It only allows the seller or the lender the right to accelerate the loan if the buyer transfers the property. Second, the Supreme Court holds that a due on sale clause, in which would also apply to a pure anti-assignment clause, that such a clause is per se unreasonable, except to protect against impairment of the lender's security interest. So this sets up the criteria that we need to use to evaluate the anti-assignment clause in the contract for deed at issue here. First, the first criteria is, does this anti-assignment clause include a due on sale requirement? And second, is the anti-assignment clause used to protect against the lender's, against impairment of the lender's security interests? Those are the two key pieces of evaluation. If it doesn't satisfy both of those, then the anti-assignment provision is invalid. In our case, this anti-assignment provision clearly does not meet either of those standards. First of all, it's not a due-on-sale clause. It's a pure anti-assignment clause. And as it was applied, Skylar Woodard even offered to pay the balance in full upon once he took over the property, and the Crumrys refused that.
So is it your position that the contract for deed had to contain an a due on sale clause in order to not violate the alienation?
For that provision to be valid, it would have either it would have had to have a due on sale requirement. It can't be a pure anti-assignment provision. It has to allow, it basically gives the lender the right to accelerate the balance due.
So from the moment the contract was written back in the 90s, it had to have a due on sale clause such that when the seller sold it, the buyer could, the following year, in year two, have sold the property to someone that they didn't, the sellers didn't approve of, as long as the buyer paid up.
Correct. And
but
just
right from the start, there would be no restriction on assignment, as long as you paid, as long as the buyer paid.
Correct.
And so you're extrapolating that from a case that evaluated whether a due on sale clause is a restraint on alienation, and now it seems to be, in what case would there not have to be a due on sale clause under your theory for an anti-assignment provision to be valid?
In a contract for deed.
There always needs to be one, is your
position. Well, there could be no restrictions on assignment.
No, if there's an anti-assignment provision, it always needs to be accompanied by a due on sale clause to be valid.
So,
is that your position?
So it would either have to be written in the contract for deed that there's this due on sale requirement, or there is as referenced in the briefing, there is it also, if it doesn't have the due on sale language, it can be interpreted as a due on sale clause. Although these aren't the facts of the case, theoretically, if the Crumrys came to Skyler and forced him to pay the balance because of the transfer or because of Jeffrey Woodard's death, they would have a better argument because this would be interpreted as a due on sale clause. But that's not what happened here, and he even offered to pay the balance, and they refused it. So that is one way of interpreting this.
You're saying Skyler offered to pay?
Skyler, yes.
Okay, but that's a little different because he's not the party to the contract for deed. So what would prevent Mr. Woodard from prepaying or paying the balance and then entering into the TODD? Aren't there provisions in the contract that allow for someone to pay it before the term?
Well, that leads to another problem with this contract for deed, which is referenced in the briefing, where you cannot couple a due on sale clause with a prepayment restriction, and this contract had a prepayment restriction in it. So to put this in the, to answer your question in the context of a cancellation of contract for deed, if this provision were to be construed as a due on sale clause, if the court determined that yes, this provision is valid, but we need to construe it as a due on sale clause, then that would go to the issue of cure. Of the breach of the contract for deed. The Crumrys could have in the notice of cancellation demanded that the contract for deed be, the balance of the contract for deed be paid in order to cure the claimed default. And that's the same thing you're gonna see in a mortgage acceleration.
Let me go back because I want to make sure that I asked like three questions at once. So, what do you think in the contract is the closest thing to due on sale? Because there are provisions about paying ahead and prepaying, if you will.
There are provisions about prepaying. There is...
When is the soonest that the balance could have been paid?
So the provisions restricting prepayment, those are not on their face invalid. Jeffrey Woodard could have paid in accordance with those. However, you cannot have both a restriction against prepayment and not allow payment as far as due on sale goes.
Because the problem, tell me if I'm right, the problem that you're identifying is that the prepayment provisions never let you pay off the whole until the end of the term. Is that right? It let
Correct.
You pay off a percentage, a maximum percentage of the outstanding principal.
Correct.
And so it dictated that the term last until it's, or that payment not be complete until the
right.
end of the term. Is that right?
Correct.
And you're saying a buyer needs to be able to pay it off fully early in order to assign it. Otherwise, it's an invalid contract.
Right. You can
is
have,
that your argument?
You can have one or the other. I think this is the answer. To answer your question, yes. So you can have one or the other. You can have restrictions on prepayment, but you can't have any anti-assignment if you're going to have that.
Okay, and that is that not a new? Would that not be a new principle of law? I mean, is there any case that we can look? So you're not saying that we should find that term in there, a due on sale term in the contract, that it includes it. You're saying that without it, it's an invalid contract?
Well, I'm not saying the whole contract is invalid.
Okay.
I'm saying that the anti-assignment provision is void.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Yes. And is there a case... Is that not novel, I guess? Are you asking us to do something new, or is a case that we could look at where we would find, oh, in fact, that is the holding of that case?
It's absolutely not novel.
Is Holiday Acres a case that you would
Holiday
point
Acres
to?
Is the key case on this. There is, you know, going back to kind of the restraint on alienation, which that concept has been around even before this country was founded, but there's the In Re Estate of Anderson that spells out. There's the where it spells out that you can't if a contract for sale if A sells to B, A can't prevent B from selling the contract. But that's set forth in the Estate of Anderson case, and it's among others.
Well, there's a response to this Holiday Acres case in the respondent's brief, and I'll let you jump the gun here and respond to that response. And he says that court in Holiday Acres actually states that a due-on-sale clause is unreasonable unless used to protect a lender's security interest, and basically says that's the proposition that case stands for, and that this case doesn't have a due on sale provision, so it really isn't applicable.
Right,
respond to that.
Yes, and that goes to the fact that the fact that it doesn't have a due on sale clause is the problem. The Holiday Acres case explains that the reason why a due-on-sale clause is not an unreasonable restraint is because that doesn't actually restrain the alienation. It only allows the lender to accelerate the balance upon transfer. And so that is the problem here, that it doesn't contain a due on sale clause. It's not a good thing for them that it doesn't contain a due on sale clause.
Is there a difference between the prepayment in paragraph 5, as you're saying, the restrictions on prepayment in this contract for deed, and what was before the court in the Holiday Acres court in terms of the prepayment restrictions?
I guess I'm sorry. I don't quite follow the question, Your Honor.
I'm asking you to compare the contract language on the prepayment, not the transfer, anti-transfer clause, but the prepayment provisions in paragraph 5. You cite to that in your brief. You say, quote, likewise, the contract for deed does not allow for prepayment. You cite to the clause, as I read it, it does allow for prepayment. There are some restrictions to it. And so now my question is, how are those restrictions similar or different to what was at place in Holiday Acres?
So, well, in Holiday Acres, the key problem, though, in Holiday Acres was the fact that they assigned portion of the property at issue there. I'm honestly not aware of a issue regarding the prepayment penalty in Holiday Acres.
So what is the restriction on prepayment in paragraph 5?
So as I recall, not having it right in front of me, the restriction on prepayment, it puts a max on the amount that the Woodards could prepay in a given year. I believe it was $5,000. And so in this case, had Jeffrey Woodard gone to the Crumries and asked to prepay, they would have said, well, you can only pay $5,000 or whatever the number is in the contract for deed, which again goes to the issue, you can't have a restriction on prepayment and a due on sale.
Okay, I know you're out of time, but please go ahead,
all
Judge
right.
Hooten.
And I want you to respond to this because I think it's a big point that the respondent makes, and you're going to have to deal with it sooner or later anyway. The respondent basically says there's a freedom, a right to contract however you want to contract in this state, and that obviously this land was very, very precious to the sellers, and they wanted to remain in the, I assume they wanted it to remain in the family or with someone that they felt comfortable with. So they basically, in return and consideration for this anti-assignment provision, gave the land, you know, at a very, very reasonable price. I understand the land is worth about almost $800,000 now. But they bought it for, I think it was $450. It changed to $600 a month, and they were able to live on that land for a very generous amount each month, and for the 23 years they were on that land, and in return they wanted the right to say during that term of that contract for deed, who that land would be assigned to in the event that the buyers didn't stay on the land. So that was a bigger deal to them than the price. So all this discussion about the price seems to be kind of irrelevant in this situation where it's a family farm. How do you respond to that? I mean, what? Why should this court basically prohibit a family farmer from setting up a contract like this? Because that's essentially what you're asking us to do.
Yes, Your Honor. So a few points, which I'll try to be brief in response to that. First of all, the district court and that's all parole evidence. The Mr. Crumry's affidavit that they wanted to keep the farm and the family because of sentimental value. The negotiations on the price, whether or not that price was how in line with the market that price was, this is all parole evidence. The we look at the contract and we look at the standard. The contract has an anti-assignment provision. The standard is that an anti-assignment provision is proper when it's used to protect the security interest. That's what the court needed to analyze. How does this impact the Crumrys' ability to get paid, and how does it impact their security interest? There is no...
What you're saying is that's the only consideration to protect the security interest, and that the law precludes another interest, which one could infer from the contract, which is to limit to whom it could be assigned.
Correct. Okay. And, Your Honor, if the Crumrys wanted that ability to take the property back upon Jeffrey Woodard's death or Lisa Woodard's death, they would have and should have given them a life estate. What they gave them was a warranty deed. The contract for deed only served as the financing instrument. A contract for deed is not an instrument used to allow for broader estate defeasance. And so...
I think, Judge Hooten... Good? Okay, great. You'll have time for rebuttal, too.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for respondent.
Sorry. Tall guy.
Yes.
That's why we put that in.
Yep.
Okay, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brian Nimchek. I'm the attorney for the defendants, Marion and Nathan Crumry, who are behind me and to my left in the courtroom this morning. Your Honors, certainly there are a lot of arguments made in this case, but it seems the court is by far most interested in the restraint on alienation argument, so that's where I believe I will begin. And I want to make something real clear at the outset. This argument was really only developed at great length on Holiday Acres in the reply brief by the plaintiffs. And as we reviewed the arguments made in the reply brief, we noticed something very, very important about the Holiday Acres case. If you'll permit me to restate some of what happened in that case, it'll become very clear why this is important. Holiday Acres was really focused on the enforceability of due-on-sale clauses in non-residential investment property. That's what the case was about. It didn't need to get into residential property. Why? Because there was a statute at the time, this statute 47.20 subdivision 6, that by legislative fiat made due on sale clauses, unless they were there for the purpose of securing a lender's collateral, per se unenforceable. That statute was on the books in 1981 when Holiday Acres was decided. And the money quote in Holiday Acres that's underlined and which has been repeatedly quoted by the plaintiffs about them being per se unreasonable except to protect the lender's security interest was the court's summary of statute 47.20 subdivision 6. And that summary relates to a statute that sunsetted in June of 1981, 3 months after I was born. It hasn't been around since then. There is no criteria that exist in Minnesota law that are being described by the plaintiffs, that they're per se unreasonable only if it's there to protect the lender's security interest. That was the law for residential lending back between 1979 and 1981. But since then, there is no such restriction. And the Holiday Acres case, the court was dealing with investment real property. And in that context, the court went through a long analysis and determined that, yeah, due on sale clauses are fine, unless there's something wrong with the contract, some sort of overreaching or fraud or something like that, we're going to use our regular contractual tools as a court to determine whether a due on sale clause is enforceable or not. Now, what that means for this case is that it is basically common sense. If you have a clause like this anti-assignment clause and you're trying to determine whether it's material or enforceable, you look to the contract, the language of this contract, not generalized court statements about whether one of the purposes or the only purpose of a contract for deed or a financing arrangement is to secure the collateral. You look to the actual contract between the parties. And adults are certainly capable, as the court addressed in questioning earlier, adults are certainly capable of including a number of clauses, different clauses, in a contract for deed, whether they directly affect the securing of the collateral or address any other topic that two adults want to contract.
So, and in this case, can you help me with this? This issue does seem to me to go both to materiality and enforceability at some level. And we look at the contract, which I suppose you look at as at, you know, the time it's written, you should be able to evaluate it then, right? Because it's not in context, it's just the contract is what you're saying. Here's the thing. It seems pretty fair in year two to have this restriction. It seems pretty unreasonable if you're in year 29 of a 30-year contract for deed and there's $1.50 left and then all is lost because, you know, someone dies and does a Todd. Sure. You know, what do we do with that? At some point, it seems like, why isn't that an unreasonable restraint?
Sure. A few things to note here. First, that the prepayment restriction isn't $5,000 a year. It's 20% of the unpaid balance per year. So if Jeffrey Woodard wanted to pay off the contract, he could have done so in 5 years instead of the 28 years that it would take.
I'm sorry. Can you pause there? Because I am having trouble following this. So at the time, like let's say at the time of his illness when he knew that he was going to die, could he have paid off the whole in those remaining months?
I haven't done the calculations, but I think that there were less than 20. If there was less than 20% left to be paid on the contract, he could have prepaid the rest of it.
Oh, so it's not 20% of the remaining principal. It's 20% of the original principal?
It's 20% of the remaining, yes. The purchaser should not prepay more than 20% of the unpaid principal balance in one calendar year.
So you can pay no more than 20% of the unpaid principal balance in any calendar year?
Correct.
Doesn't that make you, no matter what the principal is, doesn't that make you still be unable to pay off the whole at the time in those months of his illness? Could he have paid off the whole in those months?
I suppose. No. He could have only paid off 20% of the remaining balance.
Okay, so he couldn't have purchased it outright and then left it to his son at that point.
My mistake. And the going back to your broader question about, hey, what if we're in the last year? You know, there was 5 to 6 years left in the contract. It wasn't 1 year, and there was far more than $1.50 left in the contract.
Right, but I'm saying that because you're telling us only to look at the contract, and that's a possibility that could happen under a contract for deed then.
Right.
And so I want to put us in that place.
Sure. And then the question becomes whether it's really a material breach if they've been paying for so long and you've gotten most of the benefit of your bargain and, hey, we're almost there. And you know, the
materiality can change over time based on the facts and circumstances.
It could. I think the court needs to look back to the contract, which unambiguously gives the Crumrise this remedy in the case of this kind of breach, and the statute, which unambiguously says that if there's a default in the contract, you get to cancel, and this is the procedure for doing so. You have an opportunity to cure, and if you don't cure, then the remedy is basically a foreclosure-type remedy. The court or the legislature already considered kind of the equities surrounding the kind of almost paid-off contract scenario and came down in favor of the way that it's handled with the cancellation. There are other states. You go to other states, and if you've paid off X percent of the contract, suddenly your cancellation remedy disappears. That's not what we have here.
What case can you point to where, because of a violation of an anti-assignment provision, the contract for deed itself was canceled?
The Minnesota Central Railroad case cited in our brief. And certainly there are a number of, post-Holiday Acres cases where both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have upheld the materiality of anti-assignment provisions. And it's certainly true that in those scenarios involve institutional lenders. And the circumstances of those cases were different from this one, where you've got an intrafamilial transfer and all the other elements of this situation that make it a bit unusual, as Judge Hooten summarized. But in those cases, anti-assignment breaches, and they were all of kind of something less than the full bundle of sticks of property interest that was transferred. There were the granting of a mortgage or an easement or something like that. That's been held to be a material breach of an anti-assignment provision contained in a lending document, either a contract for deed or a mortgage. And the materiality of even those lesser transfers of interest was confirmed by the court on numerous occasions.
And did I understand you correctly that under this prepayment provision, if the buyer had wanted to prepay at 20% a year, then he could have presumably paid this off within 5 or 6 years, I assume?
I don't know the exact number of years, but certainly less than what it actually took in practice. There was an ability to pay more than the contract amount, just not the full contract amount in a short period of time. Yes, Your Honor.
But the contract presumably gave him the right under the contract to pay it off much slower at 30 years.
Yes.
If he so chose.
Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, this was an intrafamilial transfer. There's no other reasonable explanation for a couple in their 70s to enter into a 28-year payment term for an amount far less than what the property was worth. There was other things going on than an arm's length commercial transaction or a lending decision made by a bank.
Can you speak, I think, to another underlying argument here, which is how material could this breach be if instead of doing a transfer on death deed, there had been nothing, or there had been a bequest or an intestacy, and still the seller wouldn't get their property back?
Right. And the argument there is that, and this is, the argument there is that the buyer, Jeffrey Woodard, made a decision to use a real estate transfer instrument instead of allowing it to pass by intestacy or through will or some sort of other traditional testamentary instrument. You know, that a transfer on death deed is a transfer. It's also a deed. And, you know, at the risk of being kind of cute about it, you know, the contract for deed prohibits transfers, and this is a transfer on death deed. It's a real estate conveyance, and there is a difference between a transfer on death deed and a testamentary devise that is in a more traditional manner. And that difference is, is that one is a species of real estate transfer, and one does that for probate for estate planning purposes in order to not have to go through the probate process and subject the property to the potential claims of creditors through the probate process or whatever other prudent or non-prudent probate or estate planning decision one makes. But the idea or the fact that Mr. Woodard chose to use a real estate transfer for whatever reason, to effectuate this attempted transfer to his son, puts it squarely within the ambit of the anti-assignment clause.
Right. The question, though, is materiality. I mean, if the sellers were not going to get it back in any event, no matter what avenue he took upon his death, why is it a material breach that it's by a transfer, an assignment, as opposed to some other method of their losing control over the property or losing ownership of the property?
Sure. And how the district court analyzed this and how I think this court should look at it is that we shouldn't be in the business of speculating as to what would have happened had the property gone, passed through probate, through whatever claims out there might have existed, and potentially have ended up with Skylar Woodard. We don't know that would have happened. Presumably, we can only assume that Mr. Woodard, Jeffrey Woodard, decided to go the transfer on death deed route for a reason, and that reason may have involved a willingness or a desire to avoid the probate process. But it could have played out very differently had he gone the other way, in which case there certainly could have been a material difference between the two processes. And his decision to go the real estate transfer route put this within the ambit of the anti-assignment clause. He could have asked permission of the Crumrise, who are still around and still reachable, and never did, never tried, never got the sort of permission that was contemplated by the agreement that they had entered into in exchange for a favorable payment term on this farmland that was in the family.
And if they had asked and said no, and maybe one could guess that they might have refused.
That's my understanding.
Since they're not, then if he had asked and said no, What was Jeffrey's option then? I guess just put it in a bequest and there would be a battle later over whether that...
I'd put it in the put it in his will or let it pass through intestacy, and I don't know what would have happened. You know, I don't think anyone can say with certainty how that would have played out. We only know what he actually did, which was to use this real estate transaction to try to get around, well, to get around probate. And the result was that, you know, it's the sort of transaction that he needed permission for under the terms of this agreement.
And your clients would have had a...
I'm sorry, Judge?
Your clients would have had a claim against the estate then?
My clients would have...
You would have had a claim against the estate then for the remainder amounts due and owed under the contract for deed?
Yes. Or I suppose they could have simply accepted continuing payments from the new owner. But yes, it you know, that might have played out differently.
I mean, that's the... I mean, would they have get cancellation of the contract for deed?
I don't believe that they would have gone that route. But I don't know how it would have played out. That assumes that the property would have gone through probate smoothly and it would have ended up with Skylar Woodard, and there wouldn't have been any claims by anyone else that would in any way impair my client's rights and their ability to do anything. I don't know that. I mean, Jeffrey Woodard avoided probate, so that never happened, and that process never played out. And it's a material difference, or he wouldn't have done it in the first place.
So is it your position, and I just want to understand this, it's your position that this really turns on whether this is a material breach or not. Am I correct? Whether this assignment was a material breach.
Right. And you know, we look at the centrality of the anti-assignment clause and the broadness of it to this agreement. You know, it's not a regular lending transaction. It's central to this agreement, specifically negotiated as an additional term. I see my time is up. Can I finish my thought, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
The centrality of the clause to this agreement, the breach not only by the transfer of some small interest or an easement, but the whole thing to someone that they had never been asked or never sought approval of it in any way, shape, or form through a real estate transfer, those factors all weigh in favor of a finding of a material breach and an affirming of the district court.
But can I just follow up? Because I'm just trying to find, where's the line, though, between when it's material and when it's not material? I mean...
Sure.
Because I mean, here we're looking at the end of the term. They've been paying for 23 years. Is that close enough to the end? I mean, you would agree that it might not be material if it's the last payment, right?
Well, I mean, the legislature looked at this, and the legislature determined that any kind of breach at any point during the payment period of the contract, any kind of material breach during the payment period of the contract, is the sort of breach that can give rise to cancellation. Again, other states look at this differently and you know, give more protection to contract for deed purchasers who are near the end of their term. But our legislature didn't put that in the statute. And their courts, as I've mentioned and as I cited in my brief, have routinely upheld the enforceability of anti-assignment provisions in contracts for deed and other lending instruments.
Well, what's our standard for deciding whether it's material or not?
There is no, just the normal standard of materiality, whether it goes to the essence of the contract, whether it's something
that... Is it a legal
standard? Is it what?
Is it a legal issue?
The question of materiality is a factual issue surrounding, you know, the language of the contract and the court's interpretation of the language of the contract.
So for materiality, it seems to me, I mean, if I were making the argument, that what you're arguing is it was important, the resale or who the sellers were dealing with was important to the sellers.
Yes.
That mattered a lot.
Yes.
If you've got a day left on the contract, there's not that big an interest there anymore because they only have one day of dealing with someone, right? I mean, maybe then it's not so material because they only have to, like, deal with someone one day. Or maybe it's not that material because even at that last day, they're going to lose control over who they deal with anyway because it's going to go through a will or some other process. That's why I'm trying. If we look at what the seller's interest in here is, I don't want to have to deal with someone that I don't choose to deal with on this family farm. At some point, doesn't that dissipate when either it's going to happen irrespective of whether there's a Todd, or it's only one day?
In your one-day hypothetical, Judge?
Yes.
Perhaps. But those aren't the facts of this case. There was something like 5 or 6 years left of payments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Great. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll speak to a few of the points raised by the respondent. Going back to the Holiday Acres case, regardless of the statute, the Holiday Acres language is expansive. The Holiday Acres court explicitly says that we got the quote here somewhere. One second here. All right. It says we will apply in all due on sale cases traditional rules of equity and law. And so the Holiday Acres court does not limit its ruling to transfers of investment property. They even distinguish, and they even say that we would apply a stricter standard to residential property. And this Holiday Acres case has been continually relied upon in future decisions by the courts of appeal. I want to make a very important point here is that there is not a single case that the respondents point to where a contract for deed was canceled due to an anti-assignment provision. There is cases where a court in courts.
They cited too. I think I asked that exact question. I think they right now said Minnesota Central Railroad, a contract for deed was canceled because of the violation of anti-assignment provision.
That's,
can you tell me about that case?
That's incorrect. So in every case, either the court enforced a due on sale clause, which allowed the buyer to pay the balance due, or the court voided the transfer. There is not a single case where the court enforced a pure anti-assignment provision in a contract for deed where it canceled.
And Minnesota Central Railroad, which outcome was it? I mean, I can look if you don't know.
I believe that was avoidance. I think I do
have the assignment?
I do believe that was they voided the transfer in that case. And that's the same with the Bank Midwest case versus Lipetsky. That was where I believe they voided. Mm-hmm. And then in other cases, they enforced a due-on-sale clause, which, of course, this is not a due-on-sale clause. And nor was it treated as one. I do want to touch a little bit on the material breach issue, which is that there is a standard for material breach, and that is that it's a breach that goes to the essence of the contract. And the precedent is very clear that the essence of a contract for deed is that it is a financing arrangement between the buyer and the seller. It's nothing more than that. It's not a tool where a buyer or a seller can use it as an estate planning tool, can use it to determine who gets it after the death of the buyer. It's a financing tool. That means, again, that, yes, the Crumrys have a right to get paid, and if they don't get paid, that is a material breach.
But is there a case law that says that a contract for deed is limited to that sole purpose and it can't be utilized for other purposes, such as the transfer of a family farm to family members?
Yes. The case law, all the case law says that it is a financing arrangement. There's no case law that treats a contract for deed as a better term, an estate planning tool, which I think is kind of what the
Is there case law rejecting purposes for a contract for deed other than financing? You're saying, you know what I'm asking, because you're saying there can only be one reason. There are cases where appellate courts have looked at other reasons and said, nope, the only reason can be financing.
I've not seen, there's no case I'm aware of where the court enforces it for anything other than a financing arrangement.
Thank you. I think your time is up.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel, both for your briefing and for your arguments this morning. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.